Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Young Conductors Podcast.
We are your hosts, Sean and Cole, two conductors on a mission to encourage, educate, and inspire young conductor teachers.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Young Conductors Podcast. This is a very special episode. We're really excited to dive into today's topic and introduce our guest and get started. So, without further ado, let's welcome Dr. Sandra Snow. Yay.
Hey, Dr. Snow.
I have to tell you that being a part of a young conductor's show must mean something about my age, and it's okay. I used to be the young conductor in the room.
You still are a young conductor. Everybody is still a young conductor. Yeah. We're all still growing and learning. So,
in spirit, absolutely.
Yes.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, we're really excited to dive in. So before we do that, I just want to say we've already shared your professional bio on our Instagram page. But if you wouldn't mind telling us a little bit about yourself for maybe somebody who didn't see it. It doesn't have to be fancy schmancy here. But just, you know, where are you right now? How did you get there? Who are you?
You don't want me to recite my memorized bio?
Is it memorized fully?
It's really not. Well, okay, so I'm kind of an unlikely person to be on the path that I have been and where I am now. I've told this story in some other spaces, but I'm going to highlight a few other things today. So my dad was in the military, and we moved a lot, very transient. So when you're changing schools all the time, you need a mechanism and a strategy to find friend groups. And so choir was that for me. So I started singing in choir really early. But because we moved so much, my formal training in music, you know, what we would typically think of as formal training, was really spotty. Like, in fact, one of the tours we did, I was in middle school and we were in England, in Europe, on an Air Force base. And there just wasn't anybody to study piano with over there. And so I was sort of self-taught from that point on. And why I thought that it would be something that someone would be interested in for me to apply to be a music major is still a mystery to me, because I had to like go into my dad's living room. I had to record on a cassette tape with terrible quality on music that I found, you know, I knew what the requirements were, but I had never had a lesson on them. I just taught myself the pieces, and I still to this day can't imagine what they heard in that performance, because I'm sure it was really not
great.
No, it was technically not great. But I'm grateful that someone said, maybe there's some potential there. And I didn't actually start really singing seriously until I was a master's student. So I came into the music education degree as an undergrad with piano as my principal. But of course, I was either singing or accompanying for ensembles along the way. But like, you know, a lot of people who I imagine are listening to this, I knew once I was, you know, in the ensemble community, whether this for listeners is choir or band or orchestra, I just knew that that was what I wanted to do. I didn't have a clear idea of what that meant, going into college. Mm-hmm. But it became really clear to me actually when I was allowed to take conducting, which I kept begging them, you know, could I take conducting in my freshman year? No, you can't. I don't know enough yet, but I knew I wanted to do that, right?
Yeah, great. So along those same lines, did you have any specific role models that helped you as a young conductor or really inspired you to want to take on conducting?
I absolutely did. And I think that I represent a generation of women that had the first series of role models. Mm-hmm. And that was a really important thing for me as a young woman, because I saw modeled for me a way of doing my work that didn't look like my male colleagues. And so those two folks were Dr. Hilary Affelstadt, who at that time was teaching at University of North Carolina, Greensboro. That's my undergrad alma mater. Mm-hmm. And shortly after that, Dr. Doreen Rao, who at that time had the Glen Ellen Children's Chorus and this really powerful professional development model in the summertime is called Choral Music Experience. And in both those settings, I saw a way that I could see myself into, you know, what it meant to do work as a conductor. And this is at a time when there still were very few women conducting. Arguably, we still have a long way to go. Mm-hmm. At the highest levels anyway.
Yeah, for sure. That's something that I think is so inspiring about our career is it usually almost always starts with someone or with a teacher that you were really inspired by. And it's like, I'm going to do that one day. I think that's just so special.
It really is. And I'm glad you brought that point up. It's so interesting, you know, when you do an interview with someone who's thinking about being, for example, a music education major. Mm-hmm. And to your point, Sean, almost 100% of them say that yeah. it was because of a powerful teacher that they had. There's a couple of times, and this has intrigued me also, where the opposite has been true, where they say, my experience was so painful, so hard, that I don't ever want to be that music teacher for other kids, you know. Right. But in either case, the common denominator is the powerful teacher in the equation.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty important. Mm-hmm. So I love that you were, as a freshman, really trying to get into conducting. Did it take you very long before you ended up having to do that? Like, how far in your program did you begin doing that? Or did you, like, you know, not do the classes and start doing your own thing?
Well, I was a part of doing some church work to get for a little extra income. And so I did have the opportunity to do some work in that setting. I'm sure I was just atrocious. I didn't know anything. No, I mean, curricularly, it was like most of us, it was in the third year. And that makes sense. I mean, I'm on the other side of that table now. And you really need some time to, you know, learn formal aspects of music before doing that study. Although, I mean, if I could write a perfect music ed program, we'd start right away in the freshman year and just build the skill in.
Yeah.
But already music education majors are almost always one of the most credit intensive programs on a campus. Mm-hmm. And in fact, at the institution where I teach at Michigan State University, it is the most credit intensive degree on campus, which is saying something with a student of a campus of nearly 50,000 people.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Also, I just want to say plug, Dr. Snow, recently, I think starting this year, you were just appointed as the new director of core activities at Michigan State. Right. Yes. After previously serving as professor of core music education. So that's really exciting. So yeah, I just wanted to plug that and say congratulations. And people who are looking at graduate degrees, this is definitely a potential option. So, but also thinking about the music ed stuff you just talked about, we actually shared with Dr. Axis in the last episode. Our conversation was around like how to practice conducting, and she shared some good tips for people because, you know, we practice in isolation and mm-hmm. all that stuff. But you talking about your church choir experience when you first started actually reminds me, I told you that Sean and I were freshman dorm mates. And it was so funny to think about the fact that we were so nerdy and we were both like, oh, we want to be conductors. And we would like conduct recordings for each other and like nerd out about all this stuff. And it's so exciting. But I'm just now thinking about how terrible
yeah.
the conduction actually was. And like what my view of conducting was going into that versus like where it is now. It's just excited to like think about that growth for people. And I think you're right, you know, starting a little bit later, it's probably better, but you know.
Well, I love that. What you're describing is the sort of non-formal side of it, which is just getting comfortable with your body moving through space.
Yeah.
And you know, nerding out and conducting to recordings is a great way to do that, right? Or taking a dance lesson or doing yoga for that matter. Mm-hmm. I mean, anything that gets us embodied into ourselves, I think, is ultimately a really useful tool in conducting. In fact, I think some of the folks who have the easiest time of coming to gesture naturally are people who have been doing that in some other context in their life. That right. you know, they've studied dance or they've been horseback riders or, you know, anything that involves sort of the physicalization of the body is a useful thing as you begin conducting study. And then for those who haven't done that, do not despair. There's plenty of time to learn how to do those things.
Yeah.
Yes. Now this is our last episode for some tips on how to feel better about that, for sure.
I was going to say, since you brought that up, Cole, I'm thinking of that arrangement of the Battle Hymn of the Republic that was for orchestra and choir. And we were like, Cole, you're going to rehearse the choir and then I'll rehearse the orchestra and then we'll put it together and it's going to be so great.
I realize I've been so busy this semester, Sean, that I have not told you this, but we're actually doing the Battle Hymn of the Republic the band. We're in a collaboration concert, and I didn't know I was conducting it until last week when my teacher Merrick was like, oh, by the way, you're doing this. And I was like, oh, great. So it's kind of an interesting full circle moment, right? Yeah. But now I know that there's some issues with the original creation of Battle Hymn of the Republic, which we're talking about and discussing in that context. And so, and we're actually, I think, juxtaposing that with Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is going to be pretty impactful and educational experience for everybody. So
absolutely. Good for you. You're going to have so much fun doing that.
Yeah, I'm for sure. I mean, even when we started rehearsal, it's like truth is marching, you know, and it's like getting into it. And it's like, I know this. But sorry, I can sometimes be a rambler. But
I totally started that ramble. So that's
so thinking about today's topic, Dr. Snow, which is going to center around the complexities of representation. I think we'll just hand this over to you to get us our
Yeah. Okay. I think we had just a little glitch there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There he is. There he is.
Yes. Radford Wi-Fi can be a little spotty sometimes.
So can ours. Great. Well, you had mentioned the session that the Mirabai Ensemble and I gave at the National Conference of ACDA most mm-hmm. recently, which was, tried to be just an opening for conversation. Many people are doing this work. It's really important work. And I think that we need conversations on every single level about what it means. And so I think we can all agree that we have focused most of our educational work on music of the Western canon. We've placed more value on that than we have other musics. And even within that, we've placed more value on music by male composers who were composing in Europe, maybe in Germany in the 19th century, if you want to just funnel all the way back down to where that kind of lineage comes from. But it's really important to go a lot further than just looking at that problem. So why is that the case? And so one of the things that I've struggled with as the music director of this ensemble Mirabai, which, comprises women doing their own professional work in their own areas, and we come together for project-based things, is that it's a majority white ensemble. It's sort of, despite our best efforts, it's a reality, and it's an uncomfortable reality. And so one of the things that I wanted to talk about was sort of what are all the things that put us in this position in the first place. And one of them, frankly, is just simply the audition process that we are all subject to when we decide that we want to be music teachers, right? And if you look at those nationwide, they look awfully similar to one another in most respects, not all. There's some exceptions. Mm-hmm. And we privilege music that requires students to take years and years of lessons. We privilege music that requires a lot of financial resources. A harp is an expensive instrument. A top-notch string instrument costs a lot of money. Mm-hmm. All of these things serve to narrow, the population of people who might think about being music teachers. And so we weed them out at the very beginning. So it's really no surprise that once we graduate those teachers and they go into the field, that they are faced with largely white groups, sort of a self-perpetuating cycle. And I think the fact that we're, recognizing that now is engendering important conversations at the university level Do I think every school is going to change their audition procedure in the next 10 years? No, but I do think conversations are happening and doors are opening, and there are signs that people are making progress. So for example, at our university recently, we've developed a video gaming major, and that does not require singing in a studio or playing in a studio. The computer has been deemed a musical instrument. That's a big step for a lot of universities, right? Because it is possible actually to grow up making and producing music on a computer and never playing a real instrument or the voice.
Yeah.
So I think that's really, really interesting. And then, you know, the other thing to think about is for young teachers, especially, is, you know, the repertoire is everything. It's everything. And when we program off, say, state concert lists for solo and ensemble, for example, we sometimes miss the opportunity to broaden the kinds of music that students are doing. And if we look at who's participating in our ensembles in the school setting, we have so much work to do there as well. And we have to ask the question, why doesn't band, choir, orchestra speak to these students? And I have a really interesting anecdote about that that solidified it for me some years ago. I did an Allstate in Alaska, and the rehearsals for the Allstate were actually in the high school, and they were in session, right? And so in the rehearsal room, I had a majority white ensemble. And during the passing times in the high school day, it was unbelievable the diversity represented. And so you have to ask yourself, why aren't those people participating in these kinds of events? Mm-hmm. So these are all kinds of things that I think, you know, we need to be thinking about as young teachers. How do we broaden the representation? And then the kicker, of course, is the connection with how that influences our practice as teachers, and what we can do as teachers. And I think I've begun to think of it as a philosophical choice, right? Because you could make a choice to teach the music really well. You can make a choice to like get the top scores in the state. You could make a choice to tour. You could just make a choice to make the best program that you could where you are and never deal with any of these sort of social consciousness issues. Mm-hmm. So it's a philosophical choice to say, no, what I see is that music is in itself embedded in social consciousness, that is the lived experiences of people, of multiple peoples, right? And when we look at teaching through that lens, we need to be able to do the storytelling of more than one group. And I've had wind and orchestra people talk to me about this and say, well, this doesn't really apply to us. And I think, well, absolutely, it applies to you. You can have the same kinds of conversations. What about Cole, which you just referenced, some problematic aspects of the Battle Hymn of the Republic? Mm-hmm. I think students want that information. They want to know about that. And it doesn't mean that and here's why I use the word paralysis in our national conference session. I think also we get so afraid to have these conversations or take this kind of approach that we decide we just want to do the safe stuff. And my big point with that is, as soon as we make that choice, we effectively silence the very people and musics that we want to uplift. Because we erase them, as opposed to making a choice to do them.
Yeah, that's powerful. I mean, I think Dr. Bone and I have many conversations about this, you know, thinking about this graduate degree. I just have so many questions. And she is so good at thinking about all of these aspects in like her programming and her teaching. And I'm just like trying to eat it up all. And it's really lit my brain on fire. So much so that tomorrow, actually, I'm presenting my graduate recital and a lecture recital, and the research is around socially conscious programming. And in my paper, I like have written a lot of like teaching strategies and things that I've learned and pulled from her, and things that her and I've tried together that it's like, this didn't work, you know? And so this is all really exciting to talk about. But I also feel that the fire that has been lit is something that's also not in my only in my teacher brain, but also like my musician brain. And I think I'm just so much more invested in the music making experience through these conversations and these topics. And it's been also the teacher brain also, I've seen that my students are more invested in this music. And I've loved getting to like hear their opinions about things. Like, we didn't like this because of X, Y, and Z. Or we did like this conversation. We are doing Andrea Ramsey's Truth, which is just awesome. And we've been having lots of conversations around womanhood in the rehearsal space because I work with the treble group. And, you know, and I've had to name the fact that I am not a woman. I'm a cisgendered man. And I will never be able to fully understand any of their shared experiences because we also have some trans folks in the choir. And so it's just, I name that and I open it up the floor to discussion. And it was just a wall of different experiences that they were just sharing. Good, bad, kind of in the middle. We talked about the Barbie movie, you know, and it's just all this stuff was happening. And I noticed, and we had the conversation kind of midway through the music learning process, how much their singing changed after we had those conversations. So because I feel like music making is such a personal experience that when you have these types of conversations and when you look at music this through these different lenses, it just really changes everything. So sorry, ramble over. I just wanted to note that, you know, I have felt a difference in the teacher side, but also the musician's side. So I definitely think people should consider diving into things because true change happens when people experience vulnerability and being uncomfortable. So it's definitely hard. So yeah, sorry.
For sure.
I know. It's so great as a teacher to hear the kinds of growth, you know, that you describe. And I think it's one of the luxuries actually of going back to graduate school to have mm-hmm. the time to really, because, you know, you're not encumbered by your daily teaching job. And what you note so many important things there. There's definitely more investment and there's more care and there's more humanity. There's more respect for each other's experiences. There's the possibility of looking at somebody different than you and saying, I hear you.
Mm-hmm.
I understand. There's a lot of power here and power in ways of advocating for music that we've never even allowed ourselves to do, right? And to think about teachers who do this kind of work, you know, the kind of space that you're providing for students, and you'll never know the impact that you have on all of them, but it will be really important. And then, you know, the other side of that, the responsibility we have to care for those conversations and those experiences and to not be the capital E expert in the room,
mm-hmm.
which really shuts down dialogue a lot of times.
Yeah. That's another part of that aspect, just switching from the autocrat to the democratic setting in the rehearsal space, which I feel like could just be another conversation in itself, you know, but there's true power and like giving true power and giving up the power and saying like, I don't know how I feel about this rep. What do you feel about it? Or you help me plan. I think that's pretty cool. Sean actually did a good democratic thing the other day in his rehearsal where he had his students come up and conduct the group, which I was really excited to see. Just kind of them taking, you know, agency and they, you know, I'm sure some of them weren't really exactly sure what to do with their hands, but it was really fun to see, and they were having fun, and it was just all.
Yeah. It was incredibly fulfilling for me to watch because when I was that age, I would beg my teacher to let me conduct. And he's like, Sean, you don't even know what you're doing. Why would you want to do that? I was like, you're right. I have no idea what I'm doing, but I still want to do it. So it was just incredible to watch them get up and try their hand at conducting. It was very sweet. Actually, for anyone listening and also for Dr. Snow, the video is on my Facebook and Instagram, so feel free to watch. But I also had a follow-up question, Dr. Snow. So do you think that there are different levels of depths in terms of, you know, what you talk about? Like for my middle school students, some things are like very hard to talk about versus like a college or a collegiate ensemble, excuse me. or adults? Like, do you think there's a different level of depth of conversation?
100%. And I think it's part of our responsibility to know where you are, know what your situation is, and what you can do. But you can still develop the skill set of the conversation. I mean, you know, I can have a conversation, I think I would in most settings, depending on geography, we'll talk about that in a minute. Mm-hmm. I can have a conversation about why doing a Benjamin Britten work, that it's important that you know that his experience as a homosexual was really central to the way that his compositional craft developed. Mm-hmm. I couldn't and should not have that conversation with a middle school choir. They're not ready for the complex. They certainly understand, but I'm not sure that I would put that conversation out into the real world, because you can't control what happens outside the classroom.
Yeah.
And you don't want to put anybody in a situation that's, you know, potentially dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think what we have to do is develop the structures and the habits that cause us to involve students in both decision-making and in contributing to conversations. And I think it's an important point to note that our pedagogy also includes a lot of nonverbal ways that we can do this. It doesn't just have to be conversation about a piece, right? Just involving students regularly and habitually in musical decision-making sets up the opportunity for these really meaningful conversations. Instead of telling them, okay, please take out your pencils. Would you mark a crescendo and the peak of it's going to be at measure 4 and then make a taper and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
They haven't learned anything about that.
Right.
So, you know, asking the wind players, you know, show me with your sound where you think that the peak of the phrase is. Let's start at measure 6. Then they finish at measure 6. What do you think? Where did we think that was important? Trombone player, what do you think? it little things like that is just like turning on its head this old model of telling students how to play it. And I recognize actually that in an instrumental context that's more complex, you have so many technical issues with different kinds of instruments that you're having to manage at all times.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's possible. I just wanted to go back to the geography thing. I think this work is more urgent than it ever has been.
Yeah.
And we have teachers in states right now who are being censored for the kinds of musics that they can do, who feel scared for their jobs to have any of these kind of conversations with students, who feel like they have to cover their identities. This is a big deal, and it takes a lot of bravery and courage. And I think everybody has to go for themselves how far they feel safe in having uncomfortable conversations about topics that some people have a really strong opinions about, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I mean, I have a luxury, right? Because I teach in a college and I have something called academic freedom, and it protects me in a way that a middle school teacher doesn't have the same kind of protection. So it's important to acknowledge that side of it also. But I believe we can do courageous work without always naming things.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's important. Not putting a label on it, like, this is blah, blah, blah. You're just incorporating it in your everyday teaching. Yeah, I think that's definitely it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Good point. Dr. Snow, I'm curious, when did your brain start moving in this direction, thinking about your teaching and through this lens?
I'm going to say that what became before any social consciousness, because I just didn't know and I was blind, was converting my teaching to a place where students were far more involved in musical decision making. That came first. And that actually came as a result of an experience I had as an undergrad, where I had to submit a lesson plan and teach a lesson. And I did it, and I thought it went pretty well. I was really excited about it. It was the first time I had worked with actual students. They were fourth graders.
Mm.
And I did it, and then I got a not great grade on it. And so when I talked to the teacher, it was, well, but you only went down like the first three bullets of your plan, and then you didn't follow the plan. But what had happened was I had heard an, you know, intonation that was kind of sketchy, and I wanted to address that. And so I diverted from my plan. And that was a powerful teaching moment for me to say, okay, well, what does it mean to write a lesson plan or to think through instruction? And what does it mean, or when it, is it appropriate to like actually deal with the sound that's coming to you in the room?
Yeah.
And so that eventuated into me thinking about what we do as teachers as a form of improvisation, actually, a really rich form of improvisation. And we're improvising against something, right? Which is all of our the knowledge, and that grows with us as we grow our practice. It's not improvising as in not preparing. It's not improvising as in spontaneous without any thought behind it. It's just saying, here's the actual thing that's happening in the classroom. How do I step outside what I thought I would do and address this thing that's happening now? Mm-hmm. So that's a kind of toggling that we do all the time. And that was where I spent a lot of years thinking about that and developing my practice. And it really wasn't until, we began to see the sort of mass murder of Black folks around the country that I started doing my own reading and realizing how short I had come in addressing a lot of these societal issues and, you know, asking hard questions about who's singing in my ensembles and I am a work in progress. I think of myself as an ally, and I'm committed to being an ally for a lot of folks. Mm. At the same time, I worry a lot about what we call performative wokeness, right? Which is where you can write something on your website, which we've done on the Mirabai website, or you can show up to protests, or you can do things, but those are not necessarily call to actions. Mm. And I want to point out, I just have to point out that we have a new person on our faculty who is doing such profound work in this area. And if you're interested in it, you should follow him. It's Dr. Derek Fox, who has especially done a great job with helping teachers understand how to start from the very beginning in this work, how to create, how to practice habits in small ways that can then become bigger projects. In other words, you don't just jump in and do, you know, a controversial work right off the top of your career. You've got to set this up, and also how you care for your audiences and how you care for the process after the thing has been done. It, to me, is the most like practical and really understandable ways of being an ally that I've seen, and maybe you should have him on your show.
He's on our list.
Yeah, we'll definitely do that. On that same topic, actually, we would love to know if you have any other colleagues or friends who are rock stars at teaching through this type of lens. I'm sure Dr. Bowen is probably one of them.
I mean, I think I only resist the question because as soon as you start saying names, you're going to leave.
They're going to be like, why didn't you say my name?
Warning.
Right.
I mean,
well, the one you just said is fine. We'll go from there.
I would point out some of the sort of work that organizations have done that really show a way forward for us. So, for example, the work that Vox Femina has done, Iris Levine, and now done over many, many, many years. And the website is so rich with resources. Or the Electra Ensemble out of Vancouver, Canada.
Oh, yeah.
They have up on that not only incredible representation of repertoire, but a large project with Indigenous people and what they had to do. It was a reparations project, actually. And what they had to do in order to accomplish that. I think of the work of Jonathan Talent with the Dallas Street Choir and other street choirs like it. I think we have a lot of organizational models. And also just to, you know, give a shout out to organizations that at the very top who are really, you know, wrestling with this, Chorus America, with some great programs for young conductor teachers who put a lot of actually financial dollars behind looking at these issues, you know, or NCCO, which is the National Collegiate Choral Organization, who's really thinking about that, or ACDA, the last Eastern Division, two Eastern Divisions ago, Penny Cruz was in charge of, was a revelation. It was a real revelation. It's where I saw Jan Taylor conduct for the first time, and I was so blown away by her work. Derek Fox is in charge of the next, I mean, there's a lot of commitment to making some of these changes, which is very exciting. I think it should be exciting for young conductor teachers because you're going to lead the way.
Right. I think this is actually a good time to talk about the workshop that you are facilitating next month, correct?
Yes, April 19th and 20th. We're calling it the Storytellers Conference, telling the stories of others. And it's in collaboration with the Denver Women's Chorus, which is a gala choir. And we think it's the first time that there's a conference where we've actually brought these sort of two worlds together, because gala choruses have had a strong activist intention and influence in really super positive ways. So we plan to have sessions where we're learning from one another. One of the things we're going to talk about is, the inclusion of our trans and non-binary students, which I think all of us still need more education about. There's going to be collaborative concerts, and I think it's going to be really rich. A lot of presentations from members of both organizations, and registration is open on the Storytellers website. I think it's storytellers.org, but keep Googling if I'm wrong off the top.
Type in Mirabai Storytellers and probably it'll pop up. It'll
come up, yeah.
So yeah, cool. That's exciting. I had two things that popped into my mind as you were sharing. I think the first one being the performative aspect of a lot of what people are doing. And Sean and I have actually had conversations centering around people who, for example, let's say if they're deciding to do a Black composer's concert and they program all this music and then they like put it away to like check that box. And that's something that Sean and I have been discussing in our own conversations outside of the podcast. It's just, I think it stresses the importance of how teachers really need to just continue learning and taking in new ideas, new perspectives, find new musics, always be digging in rabbit holes and trying to see what people are doing. You know, look at people who are, we're going to talk about some conductors to watch today. You can see what they're doing, steal ideas and all that, because I feel like performative, I think that's what I'm really struggling with, is I see sometimes some groups and some people being put up on a pedestal and some of the work feels performative, mm-hmm. But it doesn't fully resonate with some philosophical things I'm thinking about. So I just wanted to highlight that. Have you had any experience or do you see similar things in what I'm talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is the danger, right, of doing the work without really having all the stakeholders involved, right? And that includes, well, we had a conversation in Choral Lit this past week about the constraints of, say, a 25-minute ACDA program. You know, 25 minutes isn't a very long time. And if you're going to do something provocative, how do you or can you set up the audience members who are listening in that short of a time frame? You know, mm-hmm. what responsibilities do we have there? I think for young conductor teachers, I think you nailed it, really, Cole. It's this just orientation of openness. And openness can come from attending summer conferences. It can come from going down repertoire rabbit holes. It can come from following groups, you know, online that you see doing work that you respect. And it can be questioning these hidden curriculum, if you will, which is for us is like the contest lists, and that's where we do all our work. Let's start with trying to find a work concept that's outside of something that's
Yeah, I also am just thinking about young conductor teachers. I think you're right. I'm sorry, my brain. I think programming a whole entire concert through this lens seems like a very daunting task. And I can say, having done this twice now, it is. There's a lot of energy and there's a lot of really tough conversations. Mm-hmm. But I hope that something people are taking away, whether you're a young conductor teacher, whether you're an experienced conductor teacher, or that you're maybe somebody who just loves to sing, I think that this process looks different for different people. And I think Dr. Snow has highlighted that. But I think the first step for anybody is to just begin asking simple questions. So I don't think it needs to be a whole concert, but maybe you could take some of those approaches that Dr. Snow is talking about, allowing the students to become more agents in their music learning process, to shift the power a bit. And I think all of this is rooted in feminist pedagogy. And so I think there's a bunch of resources and information out there for folks to look into if you're interested in more of that. But I think it's just starting with asking the question, why do we do what we do? How is it helpful? And what's the impact? Like, what are we wanting students to take away from? Like Dr. Snow said, like, is our goal to get on an ACDA national concert stage? Or is it to like use the transformative power of education and music education to allow students to express themselves, to experience things, to have windows and mirrors where they can see other life experiences, but also reflect themselves? And so I think, yeah, sorry, I ramble. My brain lights and then I just keep talking. But
that's almost like he's a conductor. Oh no, we lost him again. Oh, there he is.
Change. Sorry. Where's the last thing you heard me say?
You were apologizing for rambling. And then I said, it's almost like he's a conductor.
Well, this is just what I've been talking about for 2 years. And I felt when I was writing this paper for this recital, I felt like it was word vomit. It was just everything that was just, so this is exciting for me to talk about this because I've been learning from Dr. Bunn, but it's also been great because I've been applying this with the ensemble. And so I've seen the impact. But yeah, we just need to start as conductor teachers, wherever you are, by sitting down and figuring out what can we do differently or what is the impact of what we're doing. So,
yeah.
Well said.
Absolutely.
So do you have any other maybe potential teaching strategies now that we're thinking about that democratic that you've used, maybe with like different age levels or some of your favorites, because you just talked about the crescendo thing, but I don't know if you have any other examples for people to try.
And maybe even something that's like, it could be outside of the literature as well, because a lot of this is like so literature based. If you have any activities, you know, outside of what's actually on the page, that'd be really great too.
Well, I could go on for a long, long time.
Part two.
What I would encourage young teachers to think about is how you can convert your teacher talk, how you can lessen your teacher talk and maximize their doing. So if you convert you telling them how to phrase or any other kinds of musical decisions and you find ways for them to take action. So let's think about, well, what are some of those things they can do? You can ask them to demonstrate, obviously, by singing it or playing it. They could conduct the phrase. Mm-hmm. They could solfège, right? Because maybe there's an interval that needs adjusting. They can use kinesthetic movement to show phrase structure in the air. They can step the beat if things are unsteady. They can tap the subdivision. They can count sing. All of these things are, you know, require them to take musical ownership and action. The key is that when you convert it over to them, then you, the teacher, has to circle back and deal with tying the bow on the experience, right? So just to get into educationalese for a nanosecond, we know from Dewey that we learn best with whole part, whole. Do something in the music, a phrase, a section, the piece. Target something by having them experience physically or by singing or by playing. Then go back and perform that section. Did it meet the expectations or not? And then have a conversation about it. Mm-hmm. Why was it effective to have you use your hands at measure 36? What did you show me with the way that you used your hands that would tell me how to phrase the piece? So it's really trying to adjust the percentage of time in a rehearsal that we're giving information to students to let them try to figure those things out on their own. But we can't forget the part where we go back and then label the thing, right? Experience first, then the label.
Mm-hmm. It gets with that idea of like conductor teacher as like facilitator. Like you're still facilitating this conversation, you know, ahead of things that you potentially would want to do, but you're just allowing them to experience it in the moment.
That's really important, Cole, because when we talk about democratic teaching, sometimes I think we lose that idea. You, as the teacher, are the expert with a little e. You have chosen the music, you've studied the music, you have musical ideas about how you think it might go, and you are leading. It's the apprentice model. You are leading younger players and singers so that they are able to begin to develop a musical imagination for what they're doing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you are facilitating that process, which is different. You know, that's different than let's vote on where to put the breath.
Right. Leading questions, like with my fifth graders and 4 year olds that I worked with last semester, it's like, do we act playing dumb? You know, I'm like, do we put our scarves in our friends' faces? No, you're right. We should not do that. But, you know, maybe a more advanced
version. Or for strings, should you be rubbing your bow all over your face? Probably not.
No. I mean, that's silly examples, you know, but I think you as the teacher do already need to know where you're wanting to go in some processes, or, you know, have an outline, but be willing to go wherever they take you and be fine with that. But you have to kind of scaffold and get to that point, I feel. So
yeah, absolutely.
This is cool.
That's what you're talking.
Yes. Yes. You talked about that in your dissertation, didn't you, Dr. Snow?
I was so nerdy for reading my dissertation.
You should blame your student, your former student / friend, Dr. Bowen, because when I was looking at things for my recital paper, she handed it to me. Those of you who are interested, Dr. Snow wrote her dissertation on, correct me if I'm wrong, it's a very long title and I do not have it memorized.
Essentially,
it's like choral teacher education things about teaching like choral methods and that kind of stuff. So, but you talked about it in there and I referenced it in my paper. So subtle plug.
You're going to get an A.
Right. Hopefully. We'll see.
Little brownie points.
So yeah, do you have any other thoughts or anything that before we transition into some conductors to watch, Dr. Snow?
I would just say that anytime you can include movement in your rehearsals, it is just going to aid so much. And that has come later in my practice, and I still am working. You know, and I think it's true. It's a little more vexing for band and orchestra players, but I have so many questions, Sean, that I've always wanted to ask, like, why don't they stand up and move and play their instruments or sing more? Or why do they sit in the way that they do? Why could you set up circle seating or, you know, right. There's so many things that because we have this idea of what it looks like. And I just encourage you to go experiment.
Yeah, well, you'll be happy to know we are working on some singing, and you know, they every time I say, okay, we're gonna sing this, they just look at me. I'm like, you know what, just do it, and then you'll appreciate it once you're done. And they're like, you know what, that wasn't that bad. But with my sixth graders, of course, they find it silly, and sometimes they'll just scream. And I'm like, people, we are not screaming. We're just singing. But I am incorporating some singing. I think singing is essential to any musician, really. It's so helpful to me. Like, I have students all the time, and they'll say, why are you singing? This is strings. Why are you singing? And I'm just like, singing is very helpful because now you're playing exactly how I'm singing it. So that's why I'm singing. So I am incorporating some singing into strings class.
I think that's awesome. I you know, for them to know that actually they what they are aspiring to is to sing through their instrument. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm going to set up something for a challenge for you. What if at the beginning of next year, when you start the strings class, what if you build in vocalizing a few minutes every class? It's just like, this is what we do. And yeah. then take it on into your rehearsal. This is what Absolutely. We do.
I will do that and I'll record it and I'll send it to you.
I will be so
Or even better, you can bring Dr. Snow in for a little workshop.
Yeah.
And then she can do all the things her brain is wondering. Circle, playing, and walking. Be a little workshop.
Exactly. Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
About this, all those young string players even knowing which direction to walk so they don't bump. I get it.
No, I have problems with the cello players, but they'll make do.
Well, the cello players, you know, I don't know. We'll figure out something for them to
do. Yeah. We'll put them on wheels or something.
But oh, Sean, but do you remember, I actually observed Sean, was it last week? No, 2 weeks ago. I went and saw him teach his middle schoolers, and he asked them to speak the notes, but they're actually singing it. So I think that there's some layers that are already there.
Like little tidbits. We were plucking, and I said, please say the notes as you pluck them. And just naturally, some of them were singing. So I'm just like building it up.
And my ear was like, oh. Okay.
Oh, yes. And to that end, I'm just going to say one thing to the band and orchestra undergrads out there. If you're listening, take a semester and sing in choir. You'll never regret it. Ever, ever, ever. It helps your own musicianship. Plus, every year in August, I get the call, Dr. Snow, I got this really great band job, but I have to teach a section of choir.
Right.
That's a good point.
It's also where it comes in handy if your best friend is a choir person. So thank you, Cole.
That too. Yeah. That was well coordinated, gentlemen.
Yeah, yeah. I hope that I don't ever have to teach strings, but you just never know.
You never know. So,
I did play violin when I went to observe Sean.
That's
it,
true.
It wasn't great.
A nice D major scale. It was great.
improvising as I was going. So I was like, I think this is the note. So that's great. Well, thanks, Dr. Snow, for having this conversation. Yes, and hopefully it's sparking some fire and some interest in people to begin researching and trying new things. And I do want to highlight that I think it's okay to fail sometimes in mm-hmm. our teaching and our practice. You know, if you try one of these things and it doesn't work, it's totally okay to be like, it didn't work, I'm going to try something else, or take it back. You know, brainstorm some new activities, but like, be okay with your failure, especially because these conversations and things we're doing, like, we're asking our students to be vulnerable. And I think that us as teachers should also be willing to be vulnerable as well and highlight that we are not perfect and we make mistakes, which also goes into that power dynamic and all this stuff. So
I have a trail littered with failure debris, and it's actually how we grow. I'm so glad you brought that point up. I mean, we're not going to get it right all the time. I still don't get it right. And it's just important, again, to go back to what I said earlier. If you're just open to new experiences, that's the prerequisite. The rest of it, you'll figure out.
Yeah, that's a good point. Openness. Yeah. So transitioning into the conductors to watch. Actually, I'm going to let Sean start his off.
Okay. So my conductor to watch is Maestro Alexander Jimenez from Florida State University. I got to meet him very briefly at the College Orchestra Directors Association conference. That was a year ago, the 2023 conference. I actually was a masterclass participant in that, and I got to conduct the Florida State University Orchestra, and they were fantastic to work with. And they performed before we did the workshop, and I really loved his conducting, and it was a great program. And I do believe that his orchestral conducting program is like one of the leading programs in the country. So, definitely check him out at Florida State University.
Yeah. I'll go next. And mine is actually Morna Edmondson, the Electra Women's Choir. She was first introduced to me actually by Dr. Appelstadt. Because I was talking to Dr. Appelstadt about me being a left-handed conductor. And she was like, you know who you should watch is Morin Edmondson. And so I just went on a rabbit hole and found her. And I've been in love with everything that the Electra Women's Choir is doing. There's such thought-provoking music, really intense conversations. But I think it's been really paying off for them. So you should definitely check them out. And just if you can find a video of Morna conducting, you'll see the left hand. Or you may not even notice, which most people don't. Yes, because it doesn't matter. So anyhow, that's mine. So Dr. Snow?
That's so great. I'm sorry. I'm just basking in the Morna moment. She's done so much. And again, that website is one of the richest anywhere. It's just really, really well done. And her commitment to, you know, providing resources for all of us is really.
Oh, yeah. The website, it's just, I've been like researching some pieces that they were doing and it's just, everything is on there. So it is a good resource. Thank you for pointing that out. I should have said that. So.
A great public service, actually. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I mentioned the name Dr. Jan Taylor because I saw her live for the first time on an ACBA Eastern Division conference. She did like a director's chorus, and I bring her work up because I think it's an example of what we have been talking about today. And in some ways we have had stratified kind of professional experiences. And so the work of our HBCU universities has not always been visible in ways that they absolutely should. And I think what is important about that is that that's on us, right? That this work has been going on for a long, long time. I saw Jason Max Ferdinand work as a young man, and the kinds of things that were happening artistically were every bit or more elevated than anything that we were doing in our professional organizations. Jan Taylor has been really important in that community. And when I saw her work, it's just everything. It's the artistic package. It's the commitment to the repertoire. It's the way that she interacts with her humanity that shines through. It's her absolutely deep, you know, like ability to craft a piece that comes from a deep well of knowledge. And I mean, I just think her work is fantastic, and I'm excited to know who she is now. And I wish I had known 25 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I'm excited to check her out.
Me too.
And see kind of, hopefully I can find, I love when like conductors, there's like teaching videos of them online that you can like watch a bit of the rehearsal process. So I'm hoping to see some of that for Dr. Taylor. So Dr. Snow, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your wisdom with us and thought-provoking questions and ideas. And so I know that our listeners for sure are going to take a lot of good nuggets away from this. So
absolutely.
So thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Dr. Snow. Great to talk to you.
Yes. All right, everyone. So thank you for listening to another episode of the Young Conductors Podcast. And until next time. All right. Bye.
Bye, y'all. Thank you.